Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin in Syria, or more specifically, the Golan Heights, a chunk of land that Israel seized from Syria after the 1967 Arab-Israeli War and subsequently annexed. That occupation is considered illegal under international law. It's currently home to about 20,000 Israeli settlers, as well as a similar number of Syrians, mostly Druze Arabs. Well, now the Israeli government has approved a plan to expand those settlements further. The Israeli Prime Minister said the aim was to double the population. Well, since the fall of the Assad regime last week, Israeli forces have already moved further into Syria, beyond the UN-monitored buffer zone. The UN says that is a clear violation of Syria's sovereignty. They've also carried out hundreds of airstrikes on military targets linked to the old regime. Here's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking a little earlier today.
We have no interest in confronting Syria. We will determine Israel's policy towards Syria according to the emerging reality on the ground. I remind you that for decades, Syria was an active enemy state to Israel. It attacked us again and again. It allowed others to attack us from its territory. It allowed Iran to arm Hezbollah through its territory. However, I would like to both clarify and warn, we are committed to preventing the rearming of Hezbollah as well.
Well, let's speak to the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who joins us on the line. Thanks very much for being with us here on NewsHour. Do you support the expansion of settlements in the Golan Heights?
No, I don't see any reason to do it. Prime Minister said that we are not interested in expanding the confrontation with Syria, and we hope that we will not need to fight against the new rebels that presently are taking over Syria. So why do we do precisely the opposite? I mean, I don't see any reason. We have enough problems to deal with. He has to stop the war in Gaza immediately. We have to try and bring back the Israeli hostages from Gaza. And we don't need any unnecessary confrontations with the new regime in Syria, particularly after they announced that they are not interested in confronting us. So if they are not interested in confronting us, why do we have to do something which may cause the opposite?
The government says it's about shoring up Israel's defences along its northeastern border while the situation is so fluid in Syria. I mean, do you accept that at all?
I don't think that expanding the Israeli settlements in the Golan Heights has to do with security at all. There is a problem. We don't know yet precisely who these new guys are and what are their objectives and what are they going to do. Are they going to continue their belligerency against the state of Israel or not? Syria has not been friendly to us. And we did have problems with Syria and border problems. But as of late, I think we didn't need to fight in Syria. And I hope that we will not have to do it with the new regime. And I don't see any contribution to security by building new Israeli settlements in the Golan Heights.
Well, what about the extra territory, these little pieces of territory that Israel seems to be taking there? Is there any military justification for that?
I don't think so. I think that we have to retreat to withdraw back into the lines that were occupied up until the last couple of weeks. Syria has been an enemy of Israel, has been violent, supported Hezbollah, and certainly we had a right to make sure that they are completely incapacitated. But at the present time, when the regime of Assad was removed and new guys coming in, and they seemed not to be interested in expanding the confrontation with Israel, we need to be cautious, to be careful. But we can do it from the borderline and not try and provoke anything that might trigger a confrontation.
So what is the government's game then? I mean, what message does all this send, do you think?
I wish I could understand the Israeli government. I'm afraid I'm unable to do it. I guess you heard that I'm a staunch opposition.
Indeed.
To Netanyahu. I think he should be fired as soon as possible. I think we have to change the Israeli government. I don't understand the logic. I understand only one thing, that Netanyahu is interested in protecting himself at the expense of the national interests of the state of Israel. This is what most of the Israelis think about him, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, just going back to the Golan Heights, I mean, in the past, I think you said that Israel should get out of the Golan Heights. Is that still your position now?
No, I didn't say that. I was prepared to negotiate, and I negotiated with Assad, with the moderation, by the way, and the assistance of Recep Erdogan, the president of Turkey at the time, in 2008, 2009, I negotiated with them. And the Golan Heights was part of the negotiating process. But I didn't say then, before negotiations and before the conclusion of the negotiations, what my final position about the Golan Heights will be. By the way, a few prime ministers of Israel in the past proposed a pullout from Golan, including the late Prime Minister Rabin and Peres and Barak and Netanyahu himself, by the way. Netanyahu himself negotiated with Bashar Assad about the possible withdrawal from the Golan Heights.
Ehud Olmert, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. That was the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert there. Let's head to the French overseas territory of Mayotte now, just a tiny collection of dots in the Indian Ocean between Madagascar and Mozambique. It is home to about 300,000 people who've just endured one of the worst storms on the archipelago in nearly 100 years. Cyclone Chido struck on Saturday with ferocious winds of more than 220 kilometres an hour. Although it's part of France, Mayotte is poor and many people live in flimsy shacks, vulnerable to extreme weather. Well, it's feared that a large number of people have been killed, but it is difficult to get a true picture of the devastation because almost all communications are down and services. These people in the main city were queuing for food and water.
We've come to get something to eat for the kids, for us adults, for everything. We've got nothing left. The wind's taken it all away. We had stocked up, but the wind took it all away.
We've had no water for 3 days now. We're trying to get the bare minimum to live on because we don't know when the water will come back.
Well, getting hold of anyone on Mayotte is proving almost impossible. The BBC's Richard Kagoe, who's in Nairobi, has been trying to piece together what's happened.
There's so much devastation caused by Cyclone Chido. This tropical storm really flattened entire neighborhoods, especially those which were built using iron sheets, maybe metal sheets as you call them. And this is specifically in the shanty towns, which housed about one third of the population of Mayotte. So right now we're looking at hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. They have no shelter, no place to call home. They don't have access to food. They have no access to medicine, especially for those that were injured or those that were unwell. It's quite a very devastating situation. There's lots of desolation and pain across the island.
And there are fears that the number of dead may be, well, very many people indeed. I think the official death toll at the moment is 14, but that seems very likely to rise, doesn't it?
Absolutely. We just heard that from a local official who just said that for the moment it's very difficult for them to give an official count. They're indicating that they could be probably in the hundreds or even several thousands. The reason is because it's difficult to actually move around the island because the roads are cut off, the bridges have been washed off, electricity has been cut off, communication as well. So it's difficult to reach different sites across the island because of the destruction that was caused by the cyclones.
Services are also down, things like electricity and water. So for those who have survived, life is going to be very, very difficult in the coming days. I mean, this is a part of France. What sort of help is France now sending?
Just the latest that I saw, specifically 15,000 homes were cut off in terms of connection to the electricity grid. What we are seeing from France right now is that they have dispatched a faster aircraft carrying aid, medical supplies, and blood for transfusion, and also 17 medical staff. The two aircrafts that are expected probably tomorrow, even the coming days. And the French Interior Minister will be visiting the island tomorrow, and he'll be traveling along with 160 soldiers who are going to reinforce 110 others who had been deployed there earlier. They're going to help out with rescue and clearing operations, and also provide medical and logistical support to the island.
The BBC's Richard Kagoe in Nairobi. Well, Cyclone Chido's now moved on to Mozambique. It made landfall near the northern city of Pemba. Guy Taylor is from the UN Children's Agency in Mozambique, and in fact, he is in Pemba.
The destruction is quite widespread. You know, information is still coming in from the more rural, harder to reach parts of the province of Cabo Delgado, where the cyclone hit this morning. In Pemba City, where I am currently, there's been a lot of destruction, a lot of roofs ripped off of houses, a lot of schools, healthcare facilities, public infrastructure has been impacted. So it's quite serious, and we're particularly worried about the impact on children, on their access to basic services, to healthcare.
Yes, I was going to ask you, I mean, power and water, are they still up and running?
Power at present is very unreliable in the city of Pemba, and in rural areas, it's not available. So in some locations, people have generators, but obviously most people do not have access to that. Water, I mean, this is a province where access to clean water is already very, very low. Mozambique is one of the poorest countries in the world, and Cabo Delgado is one of the poorest provinces in Mozambique. And access to clean water and sanitation is certainly a challenge. So this will only have made that worse and threatens the risk of things like cholera, malaria, diarrhea, all diseases which are often deadly for children.
Were preparations made for this cyclone?
Yes, we've seen the cyclone coming. Fortunately, UNICEF, together with our partners and in support of government, have been able to pre-position a large quantity of essential supplies, things like water treatment tablets, torches, shelter materials, medications, things for preventing and treating cholera and other diseases like the ones I mentioned. So to some extent, we have been able to respond, but we're concerned that the scale of this cyclone is very, very big, that we won't have capacity to respond to the needs of all of the people affected.
And that was Guy Taylor from UNICEF speaking to me from the city of Pemba in Mozambique. You're listening to News Hour from the BBC World Service. Still to come on the programme, Iran arrests, then releases a singer for appearing without a headscarf during an online concert.
It was both imaginative and radical at the same time. It really sort of brought to culmination decades of Iranian women practicing their music behind closed doors in the face of restrictions and bans from the Islamic Republic against the solo female voice.
We'll hear from a cultural historian about the problems Iranian women are still facing, singing and appearing uncovered in public. One headline this hour, the UN envoy from Syria has called for a swift end to sanctions on his first visit to Damascus since the downfall of Bashar al-Assad. This is James Menendez with NewsHour.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, George Stephanopoulos.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. In its final
No need to adjust your sets. That was George Stephanopoulos, star anchor of ABC News in the US. And it was comments that he made during one of his shows back in March this year that have led to the network agreeing to pay Donald Trump $15 million plus $1 million in legal fees to settle a defamation lawsuit. He made the comments while challenging a Republican congresswoman about her support for Mr. Trump, given his past behaviour with women, and while referring to a civil case that Mr. Trump lost. David Enrich is business investigations editor for the New York Times. So what exactly did George Stephanopoulos get wrong?
He said that Donald Trump had been found liable in a civil trial in New York for raping someone. And that was incorrect. What he had actually been found liable for was sexual abuse. That might seem like a distinction without a difference, but it is a difference under the law. So George Stephanopoulos definitely did get it wrong when he made that statement.
An expensive mistake. Would ABC have lost the case, do you think, if it had gone to court? Because defamation cases are pretty hard to prove, aren't they, in the US?
Yeah, well, they're very hard to prove when the person who has allegedly been defamed is a public figure. And there's obviously no bigger public figure in the U.S., maybe even in the world right now, than Donald Trump. So Trump would have faced a really uphill battle proving that, first of all, that he had suffered reputationally because of this mistake by ABC News. And second of all, as you mentioned, in the U.S., the First Amendment offers really wide protection for people or news organizations when they're speaking about public figures. If you make an innocent mistake, or something that is basically, you're not deliberately trying to get a fact wrong, you're not lying, in other words, you have a lot of legal protection. The consensus among legal experts and media experts I've been speaking to as I tracked this case was that the odds of Trump prevailing in court at trial were quite low.
So why do you think ABC settled?
I think that is the million or the $15 million question right now. And it is not entirely clear to me. And I think that the legal process was about to head into a period where both sides in the litigation were going to be able to take depositions of witnesses and potentially get some documents through the discovery process. And that's always a risky and painful proposition. And you never know what's going to happen when you're in front of a jury. But I think it is really hard for people not to think about the fact that there are a lot of big American companies right now that are kind of bending the knee to Donald Trump. And they are taking steps in one form or another to show the president and or the president-elect and his allies that they are kind of willing to work with him and willing to take a much less confrontational approach than they often took in his first administration. I'm not saying that's necessarily what happened here within the ABC case, but it certainly bears a lot of similarities to that broader pattern we're seeing in corporate America, and especially given the really kind of uphill battle that I think Trump was likely to face in this litigation. I think it's a really natural and fair question to be asking whether ABC really just didn't have the appetite for a protracted legal fight with the president, given his nature and given the nature of some of his supporters right now.
Is there also any evidence of a deliberate tactic by the incoming administration, or at least Donald Trump and the team around him at the moment, to scare off media organizations with the threat of lawsuits or begin lawsuits?
100%. And it's a really pronounced trend that's been accelerating just in the few weeks since the election already. And this is something Trump has been doing personally for decades, in fact. And Trump, up until this settlement with ABC, he almost never prevailed in those cases, which was an indication that a lot of the suits and the threats he was bringing were really meant to scare people away rather than to actually succeed in court. But I mean, just in the past couple of months, we've seen a real increase in the number of instances of people, either Trump himself or lawyers for people in his inner circle, using these types of legal threats to seemingly to silence critics and to avoid people aggressively questioning potential cabinet nominees. So I think this is definitely a trend. And I think that the message that a lot of people are going to take away from ABC settling this for such a large amount of money and so quickly, they're going to interpret that as probably a bit of a sign of weakness on the media's part and a sign that these types of legal tactics really can be quite effective.
David Enrick of the New York Times, and he's written a book about this. It's out in March next year. It's called Murder the Truth, Fear, the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful. Now, they became known as the Bali Nine, eight young men and one woman from Australia who were convicted of trying to smuggle just over 8 kilos of heroin out of the Indonesian island. That was in 2005. The two ringleaders of the plot were sentenced to death and later executed. Another member of the group died of cancer, and the one woman among them was sent home a few years ago. Now, though, after nearly 20 years in jail, part of a life sentence, the remaining five have been released on humanitarian grounds and sent back to Australia. Tim Harris is Bishop of Townsville in northeast Australia. Two of the five, Scott Rush and Michael Chugai, were his parishioners. Does he know how they are?
The only person I've spoken to is Scott Rush.
And how is Scott then?
He is back in Australia. Doctors are visiting, the psychologists are visiting, the support structures are in there at the moment trying to ascertain, as I understand it, the level of their well-being. Physical contact with the parents and their son, in Scott's case, I suspect that'll happen in due course.
Yes, it's going to be a reunion a long time coming. Is it your understanding that they are all now free men?
I've asked a few people about this in the last few hours, and that is the case. So with that, they haven't been in Australia for 20 years, so it's like coming back to a different country.
And just explain, what was the basis of your campaign to get them home, given that they were found guilty of a very serious offence, and which carries, you know, a high penalty in Indonesia, and they had to pay that price, didn't they?
Yes, indeed, and all that's true, and that's been asked of me many times. Look, I was simply, back in 2005, trying to be a pastor. I've never, and I still don't to this day, and neither does, for example, Scott Rush's parents, I've never condoned what they did, never. It's been a very difficult, difficult time. 20 years, people have been on a roller coaster, and the parents, the families of these men, have been traumatized themselves. There's only so many occasions where you can use a sledgehammer to crack a nut, and I think that's certainly been cracked many times over.
Yes, and they have paid a very heavy price. They've lost the best years of their lives. Do you think that they can come back from it and actually, I guess, learn from their experience and turn it into something positive?
That's my hope and prayer, and I'm more convinced than ever that you can't give up on people regardless of what they do. Justice needs to be done. Justice has been done. And I hope that these people can get back on their feet. God knows what they're going to do. I mean, they're young men. How do they get a job again? How do they live their lives again? How do they meet their friends again? Where are their friends 20 years ago? They may not be there anymore. So there are huge issues to face. I suspect in some way the journey's just begun in this reintegration process.
And that was Bishop Tim Harris speaking to me from Townsville in Australia. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, the shortlist for the Oscars will be announced on Tuesday, and one film vying to be included is India's official pick for the Best International Feature Film category. La Pata Ladies, meaning Lost Ladies, is a satire with a young man bringing the wrong bride home. Meanwhile, his wife ends up lost and has to fend for herself. Sadia Khan sat down with Bollywood superstar Aamir Khan, who co-produced the film.
Well, I just love the story. When I read the script, I was a jury in a script competition. And this is one of the scripts that I read and I really fell in love with it. It's a story about rural India where a young boy has just got married to a girl.
Chacha, pranam. Aapki bahu.
Young, very young couple. They're both very much in love with each other. And then he travels back home with his wife. First they travel in a boat, then they walk through a bus, through a train journey. In India, the brides wear a veil which covers their face. So when he reaches home and the veil is lifted, he discovers that the girl is different. He's got the wrong bride home. And then he remembers that on the train there were other couples as well. In India, you also have this periods where it's supposed to be auspicious to get married in that period. He's really scared that where is his wife? And this girl who's landed up at this house is married to somebody else. And she needs to go back to her husband as well. It's a bit Shakespearean in that sense. Mistaken identities and all of that. So there's a lot of humor in it. But it's saying some really important things about women's issues, their independence, their right to decide for themselves what they want to do.
Do you think Indian films have a responsibility to make films which can help tackle sexism.
I think that filmmakers should make whatever they feel like. But I also feel that as people who are in this creative field, every now and then we come across material which not only works dramatically, but also makes us think about things that we perhaps need to think about.
India's never won the best international feature film at the Oscars. Closest, yeah, we would say India's got to was your own film, Lagaan.
He's done it, by George!
Why do you think Indian films haven't been able to cut through on the global stage in terms of award recognition, despite having audiences all over the world?
When you're looking at the foreign language category, it's probably the toughest category at the Oscars. You're competing with the best film from each country. And if I'm not mistaken, this year is about 80 films. Even to get nominated and be selected in the top five is huge.
Do you see a future where India could perhaps win not just the best international feature film, but could just win the best film?
I don't think Indian filmmakers born in India are really even thinking of an international audience. So that will happen only, I think, when Indians start making films for a world audience. I don't think we have the bandwidth for it right now.
What would it mean to you to win the Oscar for India?
I would be really happy if we win. The country will go ballistic. So just for the people of our country and just for our country, I'd be really happy.
Bollywood star Aamir Khan talking there to the BBC's Sadia Khan. You're listening to NewsHour. This is the BBC World Service in London. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. Now, in the weeks since the Assad regime fell, many Syrians have been frantically searching for news of their missing relatives in now abandoned prisons, military bases and also morgues. Wafat Mustafa's father Ali was dragged from an apartment in Damascus by armed men in 2013 as pro-democracy protests raged. It was the last time he was seen or heard from. Wafat's search for her father has come to dominate her life in exile in Germany, where she became a relentless campaigner to free all of those detained. She's been telling my colleague Julian Warraker that the fall of Assad has given her renewed hope of finding him.
Assad is gone. I cannot believe even saying like the words, like to me, hearing my own voice saying this seems very surreal. But of course, his legacy remains. In the past few days, we've seen images of these detainees who spent decades in Assad's prisons. Many of them, their families thought they were killed, but then they appeared to be alive. And to be honest, I mean, if a mother did not give up on her son after, you know, 30 years of their disappearance, I don't have the right to give up on my dad. And now, you know, the black hole that for years we talked about as the Assad regime prisons is open, and the doors of the prisons are open and people are leaving these prisons. And I'm very, very, very grateful that I witness this moment, and I hope that my father is alive to witness it and to see the result of all the pain and the suffering and the tears and the helplessness and the despair and the fear, the exhaustion we experienced in the past years.
Have you had any indication at all about where he is and what's happened to him?
Unfortunately not, but also no indication is also an indication. In a country like Syria, where many families were handed death certificates of their loved ones, and now they realize they are alive, means that you cannot just give up on anyone, even if you still have no news about them. I have no news about my dad. I don't know where he is. I don't know if he's alive or not. But that also means that there is a chance that he is still alive and somewhere waiting for someone to open the door and free him. I believe that there is still a chance that he can still be saved and many, many others can still be saved.
And what do you do now to try and find out more, to try and help him if he is alive?
Unfortunately, I'm sitting still in exile in Berlin. And one more time, the visa system and the border regimes separate us from our loved ones. As a German travel document holder, I cannot just, unfortunately, book a trip and go back to Syria because this means I will lose my asylum status. But I have family inside Syria. My sister just landed in Damascus, and everyone is looking for my father. Now they will go to security branches, they will go to hospitals, they will go to morgues, they will go to mosques where they are collecting and putting detainees who, you know, who lost their memories and still waiting for families to find them. But from Berlin, everything I could do, you know, look at the countless lists of names that no one even knows if they are correct or not. Look at the countless horrific videos of those who are being released, of the bodies that are, you know, being found in mass graves or inside prisons. And I'm, you know, on the phone with my family in Syria day and night to see if someone, you know, got any information.
Wafa Mustafa. Well, I've also been speaking to Linnea Arvidsson, who coordinates the United Nations Commission of Inquiry on Syria. That was set up back in 2011 when the uprising against former President Assad first began to investigate human rights abuses. How confident is she that desperate Syrian families can begin to get answers?
We are all hoping that that will happen, but the numbers are huge, James. We're speaking of tens of thousands of missing. And while right now I think there's chaos on the ground, there may still be detention facilities that have not been reached, not open, because, you know, we have documented these facilities for many, many years, hundreds of them, and some of them were very secret and not easy to locate. So right now I think the priority should be to really make sure that all facilities have been located, opened up. Are there still prisoners alive in any of them? The second priority is obviously to start preserving all the documents that have been stored in these facilities to make sure that we can get the answers for all of those that have not been found.
Is there a real danger now that evidence and clues are getting damaged or lost in the chaos?
There is a very real risk of that. I was just very recently in touch with counterparts on the ground, and there is definitely chaos. What we know is that some of these facilities were ransacked with evidence destroyed or tampered with just before the takeover or in connection with the takeover of Damascus. It's not clear who were involved with that, but the files were not undisturbed at the moment that these facilities were opened. And then subsequently, there hasn't been enough capacity or attention to protecting these facilities, meaning that a lot of people have had access ever since the prisons were opened. And we've seen a lot of footage streaming in from the ground, showing how people are desperate for answers, desperately looking through documents. Some of them are strewn all over the floor. Some of the documents are being taken out of the facility. So it's very, very worrying amidst this chaos that information is being lost.
Are members of your commission, the commissioners, are they trying to get into Syria right now?
Yes, absolutely. We have been waiting to have access for so many years and conducted our investigations remotely for all these years, speaking with former detainees and who were released. It's a top priority for us now to continue these investigations on site.
In terms of what happens in the next days and weeks, and in terms of possible violations of human rights, are you also worried about the risk of revenge killings against members of the former regime?
Yes, we are. And we have been calling for humane treatment right now of all civilians. And we know that there are former combatants that are now held. And it's very important that they are also kept safe, not only because that's their right, but also because they can also be incredibly important witnesses. And we know this because we have interviewed over the years so many defectors, people who used to work in the former government's prison system, in the former government's army, couldn't stand it anymore, at great risk defected, and then provided their testimonies to us. And these testimonies are some of the most valuable.
That was Linnea Arvidsson, coordinator of the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria. Now, with prisons in the UK pretty much full to capacity, can parent power help cut rates of reoffending and therefore reduce the numbers? Barlinnie Prison in Glasgow is among the first in the world to allow fathers serving time to educate and play with their children inside jail. The programme's called Healthy Dads, Healthy Kids, and it allows them to play and share meals together. My colleague Paddy O'Connell's been to the jail to see how it's working.
This is Stuart Harkins. He's the welfare officer running the day. And off they go again. I'm not taking part in the running. It's very important that I concentrate on the issues at hand, which I discussed with Stuart just a moment ago.
Our role isn't actually to teach their children. We're trying to put that emphasis on them. So they have the dad's only session, which is quite educational. And then we move on today to the afternoon session with the rough and tumble, and that's basically to give them that connection back.
Okay, so the door's opening from the gym and we're going to go and have lunch. So one of the things about Barlinnie is it does not have a canteen, it doesn't have a dining hall, so the inmates who eat in a moment with their family, with their children, are side by side as well for the first time of the programme, the only time really in prison that they will do so. What's it mean to you to be here with your family?
Oh, it's brilliant. It's absolutely getting to spend a bit of extra time with them. It's amazing, so it is.
One of the things that that keeps the prisons full is that people come back in. Do you think that there's a message here that could keep people out of prison?
Oh, definitely. I've got no intentions ever coming back here. No, that's me done. I'm doing a long sentence, so this is no for me.
Okay, so we're just going to start the wee presentation, so we'll call you up one at a time, get that out of the way first.
I spoke with Charlie Ross, who's sitting next to me at this ceremony, but who's leading the programme here at Barlinnie.
The change has been unbelievable since the day I started till these kind of things are going on, you know, where we're kind of really trying to make a difference and change lives.
How can a programme like this make a difference?
Well, you can see just by the sort of examples there of the kind of relationship the dads are having with their kids. Now, they might very well have that type of relationship, but it can only improve their relationship.
I like chicken nuggets.
What did you say?
I like chicken nuggets.
It's unusual, isn't it? We're doing an interview about rehabilitation and we're being tapped by a 9-year-old. How old are you?
7.
You're 7, but you're taller than him.
Yeah, I'm small.
No, you're not small. Yeah, you're not small. He's taller. You're not small.
I'm small.
Thank you very much. This part of the day is ending, and it is important to note that Christmas is a difficult time of year for the victims of crime as well. This programme is being watched very closely around the world. I spoke to Professor Kate Hunt from the University of Stirling, one of those involved in developing it, to ask her about the public policy ramifications and lessons from Barlinnie.
I really understand that people who've been victims of crime might feel very strongly about punishment. Being imprisoned is a punishment, there's no doubt about that. What we have to be careful about is that we don't stop people being given the chance to actually change and to come out of prison as people who want to contribute to society in a positive way. And I've been incredibly moved to see how when people have the chance to interact with their children in a positive way like this and with their partners, that it really has changed how they behave towards other prisoners and towards the prison staff.
So the dads are going to give messages to the children, and that's going to be on the microphone.
I just wanted to say to my kids personally, I want to use this message to tell you how proud I am of you both. The situation that Daddy's in could have had the power to destroy kind of the bond that we had, obviously. Hope one day when they grow up and they understand what's happening here, that they understand how hard this was for me and how hard it is for all the dads. But I just want to say from the bottom of my heart how much I love them. And I promise that after this, I'll not ever be away again. So that's all I wanted to say. And like I said, I hope Paul's good.
A report from Barlinnie Prison in Scotland by Paddy O'Connell. You're listening to NewsHour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour.
Ma robe bus, ma robe bus, baroy harimosh, tu ra khoda negahdar.
That is Marab Babous, or Kiss Me, a popular Iranian song performed there by singer Parastu Ahmadi with her band in an online concert a few days ago. There was no audience in the venue, just her many fans watching on YouTube, more than a million views to date. And what they saw was Parastu wearing a black dress with bare shoulders and her hair uncovered in defiance of Iran's strict dress code for women and a ban on women singing in public. 2 years ago, one young woman, Mahsa Amini, died in police custody after being detained for not wearing a hijab or headscarf properly. That prompted months of mass protests. While Parastu Ahmadi was arrested on Saturday along with two of her band members, her lawyer says she has now been released. Well, Nahid Siamdust is an Iranian cultural historian who's now based in the US. She's the author of Soundtrack of the Revolution, The Politics of Music in Iran. I asked her what she made of Parastu's performance and if she thought the concert was a deliberate challenge to the Islamic Republic.
I think so, very much. I think it was both imaginative and radical at the same time. It really sort of brought to culmination, you know, decades of Iranian women practicing their music behind closed doors, you know, in the face of restrictions and bans from the Islamic Republic against the solo female voice. And, you know, about 100 years ago, Qamar, who's a real sort of role model for a lot of female Iranian singers, also had a concert in Iran's Grand Hotel in 1924, where she performed to a mixed-gender audience without her hijab. And Parastu Ahmadi's performance very much seems to sort of, you know, reflect or have resonance with that performance 100 years ago, basically presenting this concert that is completely banned in post-revolutionary Iran and pretending as if there was an audience. The whole setup of the concert is so artful and really gauged at the imagination of Iranians who've been trying so hard to change their lives for the better on the cultural and political front.
As I mentioned, she was arrested, has now been released. We're not sure what might happen next. Is that an indication that the authorities don't quite know how to respond?
It is an indication of that. And we've seen this also sort of, you know, since the Woman Life Freedom Uprising, where women have been pushing the boundaries in the streets, in large parts of sort of urban centers, women are no longer wearing the headscarf. The authorities at first, a few months into the Woman Life Freedom Uprising, after the death of Mahsa Amini, said the, you know, morality police vans would be off the streets. They took them off the streets for a few months, then brought them back in. And then, you know, Parliament, especially this very hardline judiciary committee, has been hard at work trying to draft this hijab law and chastity law, which has now been passed and is awaiting President Masoud Pezeshkian's signature. You know, but releasing Parastu Ahmadi and her band members, and also a previous sort of, you know, for example, the young woman who dressed down her clothes at the university in Tehran a few weeks ago, which was international news. Releasing these women and not exactly sort of giving them very harsh sentences is indicative of the current situation in society, where there's a state that is out of step with what's happening in society and unsure what kind of threat it would pose to its power structures if it went down too harsh against these women.
And is the reality that there are many women in parts of Tehran who do walk around without a headscarf?
That is absolutely true. We hear this from friends and family in Iran. We see this on social media posts, especially in urban centers. There are large parts of Iran where, you know, this is quite groundbreaking and something that Iranians wouldn't have imagined before the Woman Life Freedom Uprising. But yes, that is the fact on the streets.
And so just going back to what you mentioned, that law that has been drafted and, as you say, is waiting a signature from the president. I mean, is he going to be wavering on what to do about that, nervous about a possible reaction, do you think?
I am sure he is, because, you know, his whole political campaign for his election was that he was opposed to these very strong measures against women and their hijab and their, you know, the way they comport themselves in public and all of that. And so to have to now sign this very these drastic measures against women that aren't, you know, that affect them on every level of their lives. This is, you know, it's been called a hijab law, but it's not just a hijab law. This affects their, the way they can, you know, educational programs, who gets to be part of, you know, professional life and who gets to be cut out. It really brings in the citizenry at large to do the government's work. So people get punished at all levels if they allow any kind of behavior by women that is banned, you know, in this law. And so if he signs this, these are dramatic measures that would be enacted against women. What he can do is not sign this law, in which case, you know, the parliament would still have to publish the law within 72 hours or so. And then, but the president not signing it at least would minimize the enforcement of the law in public. And then what happens, this is really new territory. You know, the state hasn't done this before. So we'd have to see what the next steps would be.
Just a quick final word. I mean, on the issue of, you know, women not being able to sing in public. I mean, what do you think it is that the guardians of the Islamic Republic, if you like, are so afraid of?
You know, the very identity of the Islamic Republic is tied to having an Islamic polity. And that, again, goes to the core of the control over women's, you know, bodily freedoms in public and all of that. And so I think women in some ways, not just unveiling, but also presenting themselves in public, singing these concerts on social media. This has been completely sort of, you know, all over the place, really undoes the logic and the ideology of the Islamic Republic. I think that's truly what they're afraid of, because once that's gone, what is the Islamic Republic there to do?
That was Nahid Siam Dost, Iranian cultural historian, speaking to me from Austin in Texas. She's the author of Soundtrack of the Revolution, The Politics of Music in Iran. And just to bring you a little update on that story, the latest from Tehran is that the Iranian parliament has announced a halt to the implementation of the controversial hijab law that we were speaking about. That's after it received a letter from the country's top security council. That was the official Iranian news agency reporting on its Telegram channel. Well, that is just about it for this edition of NewsHour. From me, James Menendez, and the rest of the team, thanks so much for being with us. We're going to end the programme with another song from Parastu Amadi's concert. This one's called Aziz Jew, meaning my dear, and it's a famous Iranian folklore song. Salim, Elohi Sheikh Jalalti.